Well, thank you very much for coming this evening. Welcome to Browser's Bookshop. I'm Catherine Lana, and this is Oliver Soden, the author of this marvellous new biography. We're going to be talking together for about 40 minutes or so, and that leaves plenty of time for your own questions and memories and contributions. And then we'll finish about 8:30, and you can have your copies of the book signed.
If you want.
If you wish.
If you want.
Yes. Okay. So, what do you want to give us the concise summary? Of 93 years in a couple of sentences, just so that we know where we are with Tippett and what he.
I ought to be better was. at doing this kind of whistle stop tour of who Tippett was, but the reason I wanted to write about him is that he, first of all, he had this amazing life, but also it was a life that stretched throughout the 20th century. There really were only 6.5 years of the 20th century through which he didn't live. Great British composer, born in 1905, so just 4 years after Queen Victoria died. And then he himself died in 1998, so Tony Blair was Prime Minister and the first Harry Potter book had been published. And it's an event of kind of recent history, his death. So there was this huge span of his life that not only encompassed the 75 pieces of music that he wrote, the 5 operas and the 5 symphonies and the rest of it, but also a life that kind of started in this amazing Suffolk Edwardian idyll childhood that we'll perhaps talk about later, but also witnessed the booming 20s and the 30s depression and the First World War and the Second World War, and then he lived right on through the rebuilding of society in the 50s and the swinging 60s and the space race and the Cold War, and then kind of dies in that kind of technological, or the beginning of the kind of internet and the technological world, and all of that is reflected in the music that he wrote and the life that he lived. So kind of that's the kind of enormous canvas that Tippett's life is about, so to speak.
And that's the backdrop, and then an amazingly full life that you had to sum up in this book, which is probably why it's quite so long.
I think it's very short, actually. 93 years, I think I've been very pivot. I keep saying this to people.
So tell us how the book came about then. How did you have the task of trying to put everything together and succeeding?
Thank you. It was almost by accident, and I hope I've sort of broken the curse of the Tippett biographer, because I think there was one in a way, because I couldn't believe that 20 years after he died, 1998, so just over 20 years, no one had ever written a book about him. A, because the life was so interesting, but B, also because although he did kind of fall from fashion in the years after he died for various reasons, he was so famous for the last 2 decades of his career. He stopped the BBC on the day he died. He made the front page of the New York Times, his little obituary. He was on the kind of, you know, the great chat shows of the era, like Terry Wogan and so on. He was a kind of celeb outside of the musical world. I couldn't believe that it hadn't been written up. It was a huge gap. It needed to be filled, and I hadn't thought for a minute that I could fill it or would be the one to fill it. And there were so many people in a way better qualified for the job simply because they'd known him. I was only 7 when he died, so I don't think I even ever saw him, let alone spoke to him. But in a way, that's quite helpful too. But there were people who were contracted to write the biography, right back from the 1970s, and he died, and then someone else took it on, and then he died, and then someone else took it on, and he dropped dead. And it was a friend of mine, a director at English National Opera, who was absolutely contracted to write the biography. And I hasten to add, I had no hand in any of these people's demises. But he died far, far too young without even having the beginning. This is about 2015. And suddenly this book wasn't going to be written, and there didn't seem to be anybody else. And I thought, well, if it really was a case of thinking, well, if no one else is going to do it, I think I'm going to have to try, because I love the music so much, and I couldn't bear the fact that it was falling from grace so quickly. But it takes a long time to get anybody interested in a biography about a so-called difficult, out-of-fashion composer. So there was an awful lot of hammering on on closed doors until eventually I found an agent who thought there was a story there, and it kind of went from there. But it was a kind of arduous process to get it started.
Mm. And how did you prove that you were, to yourself and to others, that you were qualified for the task?
Oh, I don't think I've done that yet. Seriously, I think I was very lucky. I think a lot of people think of themselves as writers and then cast about for a subject. And to be honest, I hadn't, I was just out of university. I didn't quite know what I wanted to do. I hadn't thought at all about being a biographer in any way, but I had a subject and a kind of burning missionary passion for the subject, and that kind of made me a writer. It kind of worked the other way round. It's quite an interesting way round, because it's simply a case that the book has to exist, and someone has paid you a little bit of money to write it that you'll be legally obliged to send back to them if you don't hand something in. So you kind of create all the circumstances by which there is no option for you to do something other than finish the book. And I don't think I could have written it. I couldn't have been one of those admirable people who just write a little bit in the evening with their day job until it's finished 50 years later, because you just never get going. So I had to kind of create for myself that discipline. But I think it was mainly just the need for the book to exist, and to exist quite quickly before, I fear to say, before, people were dying off. I shouldn't say that. There were so many people to go and interview and talk to, or just, that generation who remember the days of his fame. And I thought, well, if I don't run, they're not going to be around. So there was all that kind of spurring me on. But you never, I'm sure most biographers or writers say this, you never think that you're up to it. You just keep going, and at the end you still think, that there's another great biography of Tibbet to be written in a very different way, but no one else was doing it. So, that was the task.
And you're saying about not writing on the evenings type thing, so making time for it. But what was your day job, and how did you fit this project around it? Because it was quite a short period of time that you completed this. It was 3 years in total, 2 years in writing?
Yeah, it took 2 years to write. And then just getting a book of that size through the press and the copyright and so on takes another year, really. But I was very lucky. I got a good part-time job at Radio 3, a programme called Private Passions on Sunday lunchtime. And I kind of produce some of those and do the music research for that. But it's a lovely kind of... it's a job where you work tremendously hard on it for 4 weeks and then get a little bit of time off. So you get good blocks at writing this. And, of course, it was all cross-fertilising, because it was a job about music. And then, I kind of run out of money and put the book to one side and go off and do a week on a... TV film or something. I don't know if you saw the documentary on BBC4 about Janet Baker that was on quite recently, but I produced that. So there were a lot of plates spinning. It's not easy. You don't get paid. Something has changed in the last 20 years. Even with I was very lucky. I got a good publisher, but you don't get paid a living wage to write this. And I'm not I'm not affiliated to any university. So it's a balancing act, and it's too much phoning up the bank of mum and dad, I think, really. But it's tricky.
Yeah, and you knew from the outset that it was going to be quite a daunting task because of the span of his life and all that he achieved, which we need to come back to at some point. But how about the sources, the letters, the documents, and the interviews? How did you approach all of that to pull the information together?
Well, I think if I'd known what it would have entailed at the beginning, it would have been very hard to kind of agree to do it. Because when I started out, there were about 300 of Tippett's letters in print, and I thought there were about 300 again, so that I just had 500 to 600 to read, which is a tiny amount if you think that Benjamin Britten's archive, by way of comparison, has 80,000 letters in the archive. So I thought, this is going to be easy. And by the time I finished, I think I found 7,000. And it really was a case. I went to Tippett's partner, who'd had a stroke and couldn't remember what he'd done with anything. And I was literally kind of calling up wills by the Freedom of Information Act and tracing kind of, well, X has died and he left his papers to Y, and here's Y, no, he's dead, he's left his papers to Z. And I mean, there's so much kind of, you get very good at kind of climbing those ladders up into people's attics and coming down with dusty boxes of, you know, shoe boxes of things. And I think it's all been, I think by the end of next year, there'll be about certainly between 2,000 and 3,000 letters that I found going off to the British Library to join Tibbetts manuscripts and so on. But you know, I didn't foresee any of that, any of the kind of sleuthing that you that you have to do. I mean, there's a kind of list of works at the end that has, in my list of works, he said boastfully, has about 15 new pieces that weren't known about, not published, but you know, there were things to find out, and I didn't know the scale of the research job at all. So it's lots of putting things together and just being outrageous, really, and writing, you know, rude letters to people and coming to knock on their doorsteps.
And the fact that there weren't many letters, I mean, there are various stories about that as well, because it was war, well, certainly in the wartime, how that the paper was scarce and things. So
he did make life difficult. A, because his handwriting is totally unintelligible. And I went to the opticians just recently. He said, "What have you been doing? Your eyesight is 2 points more short-sighted than it was 18 months ago." And I said, "Well, there's this man with an illegible scrawl that I've been reading." But also he didn't keep anything. He wasn't a hoarder. So he threw everything away. And there was a bomb that hit his house, so he lost almost everything up to the first 30, 40 years of his life. And we're talking about the world of paper rationing and so on. You know, you didn't keep letters. You scrawled a reply on the back and sent it back to your correspondent, and you didn't have any coal, so you put the paper on the fire for more heat in your isolated, tiny little bungalow in Oxted, which is where he lived in Surrey. So again, there's a lot of kind of filling in the gaps with, you know, because it just wasn't there. So again, not like Britain at all, where you can just, you know, row this easy course through the letters.
Though that's a problem in itself, having too much information.
Oh God, yeah, I don't know how anybody even begins to write about Britain with all that mountain of stuff and so many. I mean, the nice thing about this is that, you know, it was all uncharted territory. You know, it's the first one, so it's that's the excitement. It's new. Every page, in a way, is new.
And the fact that that Britain did keep everything because he was expecting to be great, whereas Tippett didn't have that anticipation. I mean, he didn't know he was going to be a composer until quite late, did he? Or a career in composing?
He had the passion, but it wasn't working. You know, he was a very late starter, so the official first piece is when he is in his mid-30s, the first opera, he's 50, so it takes him an awfully long time to get going. So yes, there are decades when he doesn't think at all that in 100 years time someone's going to write a book about him. And then even when he was Sir Michael Tippett, Order of Merit, and the most famous composer in the world, arguably, for a short amount of time, he didn't have that. It was in his personality, in a way. He didn't have that sense of his own greatness, and he didn't have an eye always on his immortality. He kind of lived in the moment, so and he lost his vision, so he stopped writing letters. So a difficult task.
So shall we go back to the beginning? And certainly that's where the Suffolk story is, isn't it?
Yes,
being raised in Suffolk. So can you tell us about his childhood and his upbringing and the link with Suffolk?
It was a very strange childhood, and without being too kind of cod psychoanalytical about it, you do kind of think, you know, how could he, you know, at all have grown up out of that to be anything other than kind of half balmy and half brilliant. It is this amazing thing that the kind of two great British composers of the century, Britten and Tippett, were born within a few miles and a few years of each other on the Suffolk coast. Though I have to say, where Britten stayed in Suffolk, and you know, the sea and the landscape is all in the music and very much part of his life. You know, Tippett in a way couldn't wait to get away from it and the east wind, and he wanted to move west and go down to, you know, he didn't have that pull to it that Britten did. But Tippett was born in, he was actually born in London, but they moved to a little village between Bury St Edmunds and Stowmarket called Wetherden, where he lived until he was about 15. His parents, he had the most brilliant but rackety parents. So his grandfather was in prison for kind of borrowing the equivalent of 80 million from banks under false pretenses and got locked up into prison. His mother, Tippett's mother, went to prison because she was a suffragette. So all that political activism that Tippett kind of inherited comes from her. And she was very much part of the kind of Suffolk suffrage, I should say suffragist, because she thought of herself as a suffragist protesting peacefully rather than a suffragette protesting violently. But she would take the Ipswich suffragist groups to London, and there's this amazing nighttime protest in 1913 where they all bought ladders and set them up against the plinth of Nelson's Column in Trafalgar Square, and mounted policemen had to come and kind of haul them down and cart them all off to Holloway and so on. And then Tippett's father owned a hotel on the Riviera, so there was a lot of money around until it all went in the First World War. So they had this wonderful big house in Weatherden that I visited, you know, with a staff of five and a full-time gardener, and they were the only, they had a De Dion Bouton car that was the only car, and, you know, for miles around, and, you know, there was no music at all. So how he became even remotely musical, given he didn't go to concerts and there was no gramophone then and no wireless, it was a terribly cut off, secluded sort of upbringing in Suffolk, kind of pumping water from the well and so on. And then it had these two kind of terrible interruptions, first with the First World War, where the village lost almost all of its male inhabitants. It's extraordinary. 200 men in the village, and 198 are on the war memorial in the church. I mean, it's absolutely astonishing. And then he was sent off to Fettes College in Edinburgh, a boarding school where he received, I mean, first of all, to be at a boarding school during the First World War was not an easy thing. Partly because Fettes was a very military college, and the older pupils knew that, you know, on leaving school they were going to fight and that they were going to die. So they had this, I became very interested in this, kind of boarding schools during the First World War, and this terribly kind of fatalistic, kind of Tom Brown school days attitude. And Tippett was horrifically sexually abused and eventually had to be taken away. And by this time his parents had moved out of Suffolk, and they went to live in the hotel near Nice on the Riviera, to which Tippett was expected to get himself, aged 13, during the holidays. You have to imagine this little 13-year-old kind of on his own in a train full of wounded soldiers kind of crawling down through the ruins of France at the end of the First World War. It was a hideous, hideous childhood, and so he left Suffolk pretty much aged 15, but kind of amazing, horrible time.
And you say that there wasn't any sort of musical influence in his early years, so, and also that he sort of experimented with music after experimenting with other things, didn't he? He was sort of looked at art and writing and was it dance as well? Because he had a message, he wanted to express something. So how did he explore all of those things?
Well, it's funny, I can't actually think of another example of this, where this great composer, instead of having any innate musicality, I'd actually say almost the opposite. He wasn't a child prodigy. He graduated from the Royal College of Music only on a second attempt, you know. He wasn't in any way musically talented. I'd say that blasphemously, that kind of stayed with him all the way through his life. He just simply decided that what was innate in him was that kind of the response of being the creative artist and seeing the world kind of crumble around him and seeing footage of the Flanders graveyards at the end of the war and deciding all these thoughts clotting in his brain about these hideous times had to be expressed some way. And what the way was sort of arbitrary. It didn't seem to matter. He'd throw everything at the wall and would see what would stick. And eventually it was music, and he kind of taught himself to compose. But I say at the end of the book, the great irony is that this great composer of the 20th century wasn't really a composer at all. He was a kind of creative artist who taught himself how to compose, often very arduously, and I think that's a kind of important distinction. But, you know, he wrote novels and he wrote plays when he was at school, and he joined a dance troupe and he tried to act and Britton apparently said of him that, you know, if Tippett had decided that what he really wanted to do was to join the United Nations, he would have been head of that within 5 years. He kind of decided what he wanted to do and then did it. It's kind of one of the amazing things about him.
Mm. And you said about the activism in his family, certainly with his mother.
Mm.
So
two generations going to prison, and then he became the third, as maybe
yes.
we'll talk about. Mm.
So how did he express his political beliefs?
Well, the political beliefs were very complicated, and God, I had to get my head around kind of hard left-wing Marxist politics of the 1930s, which was not easy. I mean, he was always on the left, as so many of that artistic generation were, who had yet to find out the kind of Stalinist reality of Marxism, or at least the Stalinist interpretation of Marxism. So he was very much part of that kind of Auden generation who, faced with Oswald Mosley and the fascists in this country, kind of sped leftwards and thought that Marxism at that time was the way forward. But Tippett was very unusual, because Auden and most of that circle were Stalinist Marxists, and that means that they believed really in keeping Marxism within the one nation of the Soviet Union and joining with them against fascism. And Tippett, sort of to his credit, did not think that Marxism was really compatible with the news coming out of Russia at Stalin's kind of hideous so-called reforms. He turned away from Stalin much, much earlier than almost anybody on the left at the time. But sort of to leap from frying pan to fire, he then decided that he was going to become a manic Trotskyist. And what that meant was, instead of keeping Marxism over in the Soviet Union, it meant perpetual, worldwide revolution, as in Russia. And if violence was needed, so be it. So the letters I was reading and discovering suddenly became very frightening in a way, because he absolutely believed that the way to bring about utopian revolution was to turn machine guns on authority. And much of this he suppressed in more official accounts of his life that were published. And I went to collections of political papers and so on, thinking I might find him, and instead I was finding him again and again and again, getting really embroiled at the highest levels of the revolutionary left. And he ended up on a Stalinist hit list, essentially. His cottage was being watched by Soviet secret police, because, you know, the antipathy between Stalinists and Trotskyists was so strong. So kind of discovering all this, not knowing that it existed, was kind of hair raising. And it's very easy to judge with hindsight, but, you know, a Trotskyist's view, admittedly in the early 1930s, so prior to the opening of the concentration camps, for example, was absolutely that the British Empire was really a greater evil than Nazism. And his one, he says in a letter, you know, my one hope is that the Empire will go under and Hitler win, because capitulating to Hitler was a very necessary spoke in this wheel of internal revolution that Trotskyists believed in. So kind of unpacking all that took a great deal of kind of treading very carefully, because when you're writing all this, you can't judge, you can't lay it out with hindsight. You just have to kind of say that this was the facts, and then you have to say very clearly that he pretty soon changed his mind about all of this, which I think he has a right to do. And certainly all this was the kind of extremity that had come out of his seeing kind of the intense poverty of the Great Depression and so on. And he went up to the mining villages of the north that were completely blighted by unemployment in the 30s, and he actually worked on the land with the miners and did music groups with them and so on. So he did kind of put his money where his mouth was. And then something happens in 1939, and he has a passionate love affair, comes to an end. The very real prospect of war kind of focuses his mind, and all that Trotskyist violence goes out of the window, and he turns his back on it, and he becomes an absolute pacifist and decides that violence of any form, for any reason really, or warfare, even against the threat of Hitler, is something with which he can't be involved. And that's when he becomes a conscientious objector, which was rather better known about, and goes to prison for not... He was given military exemption, as he applied for, but he was told to go and do agricultural work for the war effort in Bedfordshire, which would have meant putting his composition on hold, putting his jobs on hold, giving up music for an unknowable time, and he said, no, my contribution to the war effort is music, and it was for that reason that he went to prison. And again, that's a stance I think people then and now find a little difficult, but that's what he said.
And is that where did he and Britain meet in prison? Did Britain come and do a
He did. It's this amazing thing. Britain had been in also a pacifist, also a conscientious objector, who escaped prison for various reasons. And Tippett and Britain had met just under a year before. Britain had been in America. He came back in early 1942, and he and Tippett met in late 1942. And contrary to popular belief, started a rather intense friendship rather than the rivalry that's often talked about. That, you know, they had a wonderful kind of almost a platonic love affair. They loved each other, certainly for those intense years of the war. And Britain and Peter Pears, the tenor, his partner, came to Wormwood Scrubs to give a concert while Tippett was inside. It's an extraordinary moment, because they had to tell the authorities it was just a random choice, you know, and that they didn't know anything about prisoner number 5832, Tippett had actually started, can you believe, a little ramshackle orchestra in the prison with loaned instruments that the local authority kind of bussed in to Wormwood Scrubs. And they moved the little clangy upright piano out of the recreation room and into the chapel, which is the largest prison chapel in England. And Piers and Britain arrived. And Britain said to the authorities in the prison, well, I'm going to have a page turner, and I haven't brought one. Which was nonsense, of course. But you know, that tall chap in the front row looks fine. And they said, yeah, okay. And it was Tippett, of course. So he came and sat next to Britain at this clangy upright piano, still in his prison uniform. So, you know, flannel jacket and trousers and hat and so on. And they, you know, they played in this concert. It's amazing. But it wasn't all concerts with Britain. You know, it was a difficult time, and although it was the middle of 1943, so there was a temporary lull on air raids, but certainly the warders thought that the conscientious objector's so-called crime was worse than say the black marketeers and the murderers who were also on the corridor. So, you know, it wasn't always a given that the conscientious objectors would get into the air raid shelter underneath the prison during a raid, because they were sometimes elbowed out. So it was a difficult time.
And what can we learn about the music from the story, the background, the story of the man that you've presented here? I mean, what can we draw out from that?
It was difficult. This kind of caused me bother all the way through, because I don't like those biographies that just assume that every single piece is in some way the life story in code. I never buy that. I think it does a sort of disservice to the imagination. And I think in some way, you know, I hope there's something in the book, even if you think you're tone deaf and have never heard a note of music in your life. Because in some ways, I tried to separate the life and the music. Oh, you know, you can't really do that. But nevertheless, you know, T.S. Eliot certainly thought that the greater the artist, the more separate was the art from the life, and that was something Tippett took very seriously. That you know, he didn't always pour himself out into the notes. But of course, in other ways, of course, the life and the music is intertwined for all kinds of reasons. First of all, you know, just explaining everything I've been talking about, everything he was doing up in Yorkshire with the Trotskyists in prison, kind of just explains how long it took him to get going. And of course, there are bits of his life story you can read into the music if you want to. But for me, it was much more about, if you hear Tippett's music, one of the things people often comment upon is this amazing sort of personality it has. It's never anonymous. It couldn't be by anybody else, whether it's the invention of the rhythm or the fact that in one symphony it quotes from Beethoven but also from a blues song, or the fact that late on he suddenly decides he's going to get interested in rap music and electronic music in his late 80s, or any of that. You want to work out who the personality was that could kind of embrace all of this and bring it together and experiment. And I mean, it sounds very far-fetched, but a composer called Alexander Gair said, well, if you listen to the way Tippett spoke, he spoke very, very oddly. He put the accents on the wrong beat of his words. And I thought, did he? This is, I don't know what you mean. And he had a very, you know, smart Edwardian voice. But I began to listen, and there was a kind of odd quirk in the way he spoke. And, you know, if somebody died, he would send his condolence instead of his condolence. And he said ambivalent instead of ambivalent. You know, he had this very odd way of speaking. And famously in his music, that you know, that's what he does with the notes as well. He has this kind of syncopation. And, you know, okay, it's very far-fetched to say that he kind of spoke as he composed. But nevertheless, it was all part of kind of just working out who this brain was, this personality behind this kind of flamboyant music. And those two things, I think, are one and the same. I mean, you know, Tippett was not like anybody else. He wasn't like anybody else of his time. You know, he was amazingly open. He was very open about being gay at a time when it was illegal, or at least bisexual. He was very kind of wonderfully disinhibited, amazingly kind of charming and persuasive, and anybody who met him kind of fell desperately in love with him. I mean, he was very irresistible as a person. And then in later life, he'd turn up on, as I say, the Terry Wogan chat show. You know, we're talking late 70s, early 80s, kind of wearing the most flamboyant outfits and swearing and telling rude jokes and so on. I mean, you know, he didn't act like, you know, the great knighted composer. I mean, streets away from Benjamin Britten, who was kind of famously starchy and difficult to get along with. So, you know, he was, I think that's where the music and the life intersect most clearly for me, just in the sense of a personality speaking to us through music.
So did he enjoy sort of celebrity status then? Was that something that he sought?
I think so. It was a long time coming, and it was amazing for a composer to have this status. And I mean, I'm unthinkable now. You know, Channel 4 would devote evenings to his music, and you know, BBC One would program 12 hours of uninterrupted Tippett, and he'd go on chat shows and so on. I think he did enjoy it. I mean, his detractors would say too much, because in some ways this kind of public persona, and I'm not sure it was anything more than that, actually. It's good PR to be such an irresistible, you know, he was a bit like Quentin Crisp. He kind of, he milked it, I think. But unthinkable now. I mean, it would be like turning on the Graham Norton show and seeing Harrison Birtwistle discussing his latest opera or something. I mean, it's just unimaginable. And partly he courted it. And, you know, he was on the front page of the big issue. I was absolutely amazed. You know, he was a kind of personality. But then whether that did him any favours, I'm not entirely sure, because, you know, it's at that point, and I don't dismiss those pieces of music out of hand at all, as some people do, but it's at that point that he starts to put electric guitars into his orchestra pit, drum machines, to explore, as I say, rap music, jazz, blues, and so on. And of course this sets the kind of experimental cat amongst the conservative pigeons of the various academic music faculties and so on, who say, hold on, you know, this is all very silly and this isn't what music is about. Now, I don't agree with that, but of course it was very hard to take him seriously in a way when he was sending himself up so much in public and wouldn't engage in any serious way. So it's an odd self-sabotage, and it turned a lot of people off him. But I think now, you know, if he was an artist and he stood next to David Hockney or Grayson Perry or something, nobody would look twice. So it's very much about being a man not only of his time, which he reflected very passionately, but also in a way he just got to everywhere too soon. I think he belonged, you know, it's odd because people call him dated, but actually I think a lot of it belongs far more easily now, and certainly his personality we kind of accept more easily in 2019.
So the book is very much the man behind the music, and you've done an awful lot of research to get all the information together. But the other part of the book is the fact that you've got diary sections. So you talk about you're at very much in the first person as your own exploration and things that you discovered. So why did you decide to include those elements to the book?
Well, it was an odd risk. I just put them in as brief little interludes between the main parts. And I had to persuade the publisher to put them in a different font, but they did eventually agree, because I wanted them really, you know, if you don't like them, you don't have to read them, I'm telling you this, because I didn't want it to intrude. And I was so nervous about doing it, because again, it's the kind of biography I just don't like, that's more about the biographer than the subject, so I kind of broke all my own rules that I set myself. And actually, I was lucky, I had offers from two publishers, and one publisher, it was Faber, they said, well, fine, but we're not sure about these diary sections at all. And then Weidenfeld, who got it eventually, said, no, they're interesting. And I wrote more of them, and we decided to keep them. But it's very odd when you're writing a biography. It's very hard to know where to exist. I am intruding yourself the whole time in the main narrative just gets annoying for the reader, whether it's criticising or praising or no. I think the reader should just make up his own mind. And the diary sections were, first of all, a place where I could kind of be more comfortably. But as I went on researching the book, kind of more and more amazing things began to happen, which I couldn't have foreseen. And I didn't know where to put them because they didn't belong. And, you know, I tell you, it was watching one of those David Attenborough documentaries that gave me the idea, you know, where they stop 10 minutes before, and then they kind of tell you how it's all done. And I thought, well, you know, there must be a way of doing this. And the thing that absolutely decided me, which became the last diary section, was that I was very determined not just to track down all the famous people that Tippett knew. And I wanted to talk to, you know, his cleaners and his housekeepers and the carer who looked after him for the last 2 or 3 years of his life. And that took a long time to find him, but I did eventually get there, and I went to talk to him with my trusty little dictaphone. And it turned out Tippett had died in this man's arms, and he'd clearly adored him, and he spoke for a great length of time about how much kind of, you know, hauling this man on and off the loo and into the shower and so on, you know, kind of this amazing thing. You know, all this is part of the kind of texture of a life, and it's not often written about. And then I was just about to leave at the end of interviewing this man, Andrew Costa, and he said, I've just got something I'd like to show you. Just close your eyes and hold your hands out. I thought, this sounds very rum, I'm not sure about this. And he just put into my hand this red Tupperware container with a screw top, and I took off the lid, and I knew what it was going to be, and it was just a little pile of grey dust at the bottom of the container. And he said, you're holding Michael Tippett. I thought, I wondered if any biographer had ever held, you know, the ash. It was very, very odd and very creepy, and I didn't know what to do. But I thought, I've got to write about this in some way. I've got to get it into the book, because the ashes were dug into some roses. But clearly, this carer, you know, Tippett had meant so much to him. He'd asked to kind of keep some back, and I thought, well, I've got to write it, and it kind of went from there. But it was an amazing thing to happen in a way, It's something to do with crystallising what happens between a biographer and his subject, because it's somebody you never knew at all, and yet conversely you also know more about than in some ways even your closest friends, because you're just kind of riffling about through the life and all this private stuff that wasn't meant for anybody. It's a very odd feeling, and of course it was my first book, so it was very new to me. So all the diaries were a way of kind of trying to think about those questions.
And it's had lots of positive feedback, lots of good coverage.
I'm very lucky.
So what do you hope the book will achieve? What do you hope your readers will gain from it, and what do you hope it will mean for Tippett and his work going forward?
Well, it's difficult, because I think a good biography, certainly of a creative artist, should be enjoyed, but even by people who think they loathe every note of Tippett's music. You know, you're kind of writing for those people as well. So in a way, you just want to achieve. I mean, the highfalutin thing to say is I wanted it to be more than just a life story. I wanted it to be a kind of 20th century through the lens of the man who saw it all more than most people did, and who responded to it more than most people did. So if it reminds people of that time in the 30s with revolutionary politics, if it reminds people about the conscientious objectors, if it reminds people about a time when it was illegal to live openly with another man, and indeed if it reminds people that Tippett, by the way, was the first person to write a gay character into opera or any of that, if it reminds us that he was someone who kind of nudged the world a little bit in that way, and that we owe him all of that musically and sexually, politically and in other ways, then that would be fine. But he is out of fashion. And partly I think that was to do with there not being a book. So if it does bring the music back, because I'm so passionate about the music, then that would be very nice. But that's a hard thing. Because I say in the book he was so terrible with money and didn't leave any, he died in terrible debt, so there's no money to put behind it. And people do dislike the music very intensely. It's very divisive, as often the great new sounds in music can be. And, still I got one review perfectly nice about the book, but that absolutely said, it was in the Times. I'm totally over this review, by the way. I hope you noticed. But it said Tippett was a mediocrity in an age of greats compared to, Elgar and Vaughan Williams and so on. So it would be nice to put some of that to bed. But still, no Tippett in the proms year upon year, etc. But there's a film next year by the man who made the Janet Baker documentary. He's going to do Tippett next, John Bridcutt, and there an opera's coming back to ENO, and another opera, English Touring, that's coming to Snake Maltings next year. The Knot Garden is going to come. So I think there's signs of a Tippett renaissance. So, that's what I hope to achieve. But you can't do that with one book, because, you have a little flurry, and then it all goes away again. So there's still kind of work to do. But also, Tippett needed, I think each artist needs a new generation to discover him. And I'm still in my 20s, so it was about people of my age who hadn't heard the original performers, have no memory of those awful dated 70s productions with the flared trousers and the kind of Mamma Mia costumes and so on. So many people think, for them, for a certain generation, Tippett is kind of equated with that kind of horrible, dated, late 70s slang and so on. And it's much easier just to come to that fresh when you're younger and you haven't seen them, and, it becomes more of a period piece. And it was a lot about a kind of new, giving Tippett to a new generation, if that doesn't sound too much, but partly about that.
Okay. Right. Well, I've asked lots of questions. Has anybody else got any questions they'd like to ask?
It's always an awkward silence at this point.
Oh, at the back.
Were there moments when you were researching, when he surprised you, when you felt you had to adjust the mental picture you were building of him?
There were. What a lovely question. No, yes, there were two main surprises about him as the person. The first was the political one, which, there's a 60-page little biographical booklet that is all people had to go on him, that says explicitly, but Tippett was a Trotskyist for 6 weeks and never joined a political party. So when I structured the book, I didn't allot any time at all to that. I thought I'd whiz through the 30s and get to the war and it would all be happy. And then when I eventually found this huge collection of 2,000 letters in somebody's garage, and suddenly there was all this talk about, I'm not a pacifist, I'm a military enthusiast, and I thought, God, you have this fire in you that I never knew, and you had this violence in you. This man who was president of the Peace Pledge Union by the time he died, this famous, famous peace-loving pacifist. I didn't know, and I had to kind of completely stop and put in a new part of the book and, slow myself down and, as I say, go off to these political archives. So that was a surprise. And the second thing that surprised me a lot was the love affairs with women, which I didn't know about, because he'd been so famously openly gay, and he'd lived very openly with quite a number of men. But I just didn't know about the women he had loved. Maybe not necessarily sexually, but it was more than just the platonic friendship. I mean, these were great, great love affairs that I talk about in the book. And lots of marriage proposals, too, that simply weren't known about. And whether that was just about wearing a wife as a disguise amidst all the witch hunts in the 50s, there may be something with that. But, you know, I didn't know he'd decided that Ray Vaughan Williams's widow, Ursula, ought to marry him, and he wrote to her. So I just didn't know about this. And I think partly in the late 70s it was quite... I don't think that was very politically useful when he was being, you know, at the time of Stonewall and so on, and Section 28. It didn't help, you know. He was playing the kind of... What was Quentin Crest called? Stately Homo of England. Or, you know, he was kind of playing that role a lot more. And then all these... more than friendship letters, kind of love letters to women that really surprised me. And indeed, one woman, amazing story, I tell it in the book, Francesca Allenson, who was one of Virginia Woolf's novelists with the Hogarth Press, that he had a kind of passionate love affair with, but she drowned herself at the end of the war, kind of emulating Woolf, and it left him bereft like a widower, really. And I wasn't expecting any of that at all. So it was those two things, I think.
When you think of someone like Vaughan Williams, who had Barbara Ollie and Bolt, as it were, sort of promoting his music, how important was Colin Davis in the last years of Tippett's life for promoting and, you know, really sort of celebrating his music?
I'd say vastly.
He would.
Colin Davis, the great conductor, who became such a Tippett advocate. And this was the problem, that some of the influences on Tippett's quite early stuff in the 30s, 40s, 50s, a lot of it came from Europe, and a lot of it came from jazz, and a lot of it came from early music, Monteverdi, Purcell, and so on, none of which was especially in fashion. And you'd get the great conductors of the day, Barbarolli among them, Adrian Bolt, Malcolm Sargent, looking at a Tippett score and thinking it was full of mistakes. And Tippett would say, no, it's just a technique I've taken from Monteverdi, where you have two notes a semitone apart that eventually resolve or whatever. And the great conductors you mentioned didn't know what to do with this. So in Tippett's Second Symphony, for example, the premiere in 1958, it actually broke down on live, on radio, you know, the great premiere, and it just fell apart, because nobody knew how to conduct it. And it wasn't until 63 when Colin Davis up in Edinburgh conducted the premiere of Tippett's Concerto for Orchestra, very thorny Stravinsky middle period Tippett piece. And suddenly he kind of made sense of it, because he was a new generation, he understood early music, he understood new music. And then I think Colin Davis did 8 Tippett premieres, and they were kind of close, but quite a wary friendship. That was another surprise. I thought Colin Davis and Tippett, because Davis had such an affinity for the music, I thought they'd be bosom friends. And actually, it was a bit of a slightly more difficult than that. Mm-hmm. But then what Davis did was to go back to the early works, the First Symphony, Concerto for Double String Orchestra, Child of Our Time, and kind of work through them, and he understood them. So he kind of did all that work for Tippett. It's a bit like Eric Fenby and Delius or something. I think without Colin Davis, Tippett's later career would be... I mean, there were others, Norman Del Mar, and eventually Schulte, and all fell for Tippett in a big way, and Haitink a little bit. But Colin Davis was such an advocate, absolutely.
Thank you.
How did you learn about Michael Tippett and his work?
I always wish I had a better answer. I wish I'd been walking down the street and I suddenly heard the opening of the Second Symphony and thought I had to dedicate my life to this. And it's nothing like that at all, actually. I just heard little bits when I was at school. I had a music teacher who was of that generation, you know, where young musicians in the 60s absolutely... I mean, it's amazing to look back, 60s and 70s, and you absolutely see young composers and young audience members going, well, of course, you know, Benjamin Britten will not last, and Tippett is so clearly the greater figure. Now, I don't agree with that, I hasten to add, although I think, you know, I wish they were more on a level in audiences' affection. But my music teacher was very much part of that generation that bought T-shirts that you could get which said, turn on to Tippett, please. So, he had a fan club. So he had CDs, and I heard A Child of Our Time, which I'm sure a lot of you know, with the African-American spirituals all through. And I heard one of those, and I mean, that just goes straight through me, that spiritual. I think it's just, the spiritual, I think, is wonderful. And I'd heard little bits, and then I read English at university, and I was writing a lot on T.S. Eliot, and Tippett was really the only composer that T.S. Eliot had much to do with. And in fact, Eliot was going to write the words for A Child of Our Time for a short time. So I kind of came in that way. I came in through Tippett's love of the literary world, and Yeats and Auden. And I still think there's more kind of work to be done there. So I graduated, and then, as I say, all the kind of Tippett experts were just kind of dying off like flies. And someone wrote to me and said, well, you know, would you do a program? You know, I didn't have anybody to get out of the way. There was nobody writing on Tippett. So I kind of did a program, and it sort of went from there. But it was a very, very slow build-up.
Are you a trained musician yourself, or did you just do it at school, as it were?
I mean, by no means a trained musician, which kind of both... And I don't have a degree. It's a total disqualification to write the book, and yet it was also, dare I say it, my very best qualification, simply because I hoped that readers wouldn't be trained musicians. And I think it's, if you're really missionary about something, and if the life is very interesting, it's actually no good saying, and oh my God, the way he goes from F sharp major to G flat minor there, isn't it just amazing? And then you get your academic press selling your book for 250 quid, and that's that, you know. Not to do down those books, but nevertheless, it wasn't the kind of book I could write. I mean, I play the piano, and I listen to a lot of music, but I think it's an interesting thing. There's somehow this idea that you can't, as it were, write a literary biography about a composer. There hasn't been one. I mean, this is the first one for since the Britain centenary, which is 7 years ago or something. You know, finding a biography of a composer in the front desks of a bookshop for everyone, hopefully to read, is a difficult thing, but an important one, I think. Although, you know, some academics haven't been so sure I've been the right person to do this. But no, not a trained musician at all.
My late wife, Elizabeth Harwood, performed the role of Bella.
Yes,
in
she
1968,
did.
In April 68, in Covent Garden. She was
nice
pregnant
to meet you.
At the time,
yes,
and even
yeah.
adjusted the dress accordingly. But so appropriately, the next year, in 70, she did A Child of Our Time in Cambridge. And the sequence of events was so appropriate at the time. And I did remember meeting Tippett, and we laughed about the sequence around that. Midsummer Marriage, followed by A Child of Our Time. And it was very topical for us because our son was born in 1968 in July.
So. Oh, how wonderful. And I know he wanted Elizabeth Harwood to sing in the Knot Garden as well.
Indeed,
and she had to go, and Jill Gomez was brought in at
correct.
The last
that,
minute.
That reference comes into your book, I saw.
Yes.
That, yeah.
Oh, well, yeah. Lovely to meet you. And people who say they saw the Janet Baker documentary will remember her venerating Elizabeth Harwood as amongst her greatest of her colleagues. Voice like clotted cream, she said. Absolutely.
We thought it was a magnificent production. I spoke to John Woodcock to have a good chat about what possibly he could put in. And
good.
There was some nonsense on copyright with the Royal Northern College, which we sorted out.
Good, well, it happens.
I do notice there's one copy of the Midsummer Marriage recording available. I bought details. I don't. You probably know all about it. But,
I have the one that she sang on. Is
yes.
It was this. The Midsummer Marriage is Tippett's first opera that was a kind of almost complete flop when it premiered in 55, even though Barbara Hepworth had done the sets, which actually meant that they were immovable and no one could sing on them. But nevertheless, Barbara Hepworth's sets, important moment. And it wasn't until really this revival under Colin Davis at Covent Garden that had Elizabeth Harwood as the secretary, Bella, with a glorious aria about putting on her makeup in the middle, that it kind of became thought of as a great opera. So lovely to meet you. Lovely you're here.
To meet you.
Yes, sorry.
For a long time, there didn't seem to be any early works by Tippett, and the first thing we ever really hear about is the Concerto for Double String Orchestra. Recently, an early symphony in B flat has just come out.
Yes.
Premiered. Are there likely to be anything? Is there likely to be anything else that we might hear in the future? Do you think?
Quite interesting. Am I allowed to say I found the score of that symphony in B flat?
Sure,
that, because you know Tippett famous for his four official symphonies, but he'd written a fifth one that the score had been lost, and eventually it was actually in the British Library all the time, but no one had worked out what it was, and it was premiered, re-premiered after 85 years of silence, and it's a rather beautiful piece, but it doesn't sound like Tippett at all. It's almost completely unoriginal, and he was 28 when he wrote it, so again it's kind of proof of how slowly he kind of, you know, you think originality is something you're born with, and you know, typically in an odd way, it kind of proves that you can actually work to achieve it. But there were thought to be about 20, and I think I now found there are 35 unpublished works written before the first string quartet in 1935 that Tippett completely withdrew. And the problem is that there's a legal ban on their performance, and overturning that, even for the B flat symphony, took about 18 months. And I've looked at most of the scores, which I can just about hear in my head by reading them, and the brutal answer is they're really not very good, and really kind of watery copycat stuff. And part of the reason that it would be difficult to revive them is that he was working almost completely with amateur performers, and occasionally somebody asks if it can be resurrected, and there's a bit, you know, and I'm occasionally asked to write a little report on whether I think the Tippett Foundation should say yes. And it's difficult to know what to say, because whether it does him any favours, I don't know. Although, of course, it's interesting on a scholarly level. And the other issue is that a lot of them are... There are two or three early operas written in the 30s, one on the Robin Hood story, that were all done to be sung with the unemployed mining communities up in the north. And the problem is that they're quite explicitly Stalinist, and they have kind of quite approving references very early, 33, 34, to Stalin's 10-year plan and so on, which we now know to be a kind of murderous disaster, but which Tippett thought would be the way forward and so on. So I, in a way, I think he's got to have, you know, we've got to let him change his mind on that political stuff. It's quite difficult to kind of proffer all of that when he withdrew it. So there's a kind of political... worry too. So nothing planned as yet, but I don't think you're missing much, put it that way. And there's a lot still lost that I haven't found, including a piece I'd love to discover written for upturned bin cans, but the score has totally disappeared.
Okay, one last question.
There's something, from a literary point of view, there's something very kind of warm and affectionate about the way you say Michael this and Michael that all the way through. But what stage did you find that was the way you were referring to him as you were writing? Was it a deliberate decision? Because normally it would be Tippett this.
It's very interesting. I thought about it. It wasn't an accident. I thought about it really, really, really carefully. And partly I thought that there's a male-female divide here, because you won't actually open a biography of a woman without usually finding her referred to as her first name. Partly I think that's practicality, because they, you know, if you call Virginia Woolf Woolf all the way through, that's not going to help when she's called Virginia Stephen for the first half of her life. So it's simply a maiden name, married name issue. But I think it's more than that. I think there's wrongly a sense that kind of, you know, the men are up there on a pedestal and the women are kind of cosy, and it's rubbish, all of that. So it was partly a sense of writing about him in that way, as people write about female subjects. Partly, again, he's not Britain. He would never have asked to be called Tippett or Sir Michael, or, you know, or stood on any kind of ceremony. And it seems so ludicrous to be, as I think it does in other biographies, to be kind of swimming around his darkest desires in his diaries, kind of sexual and others, and yet not daring to call him by his first name. So it was partly kind of giving the reader a kind of intimacy with him. But also practicality, you know, three generations of Tippett men, because I start with the grandfather George Tippett and the father Henry Tippett. If you call them all Tippett, you go kind of Dulally at the beginning. And then the family did a name change to escape prosecution. So for a short time in his 20s, he was called Michael Kemp, and then he decided that was nonsense and went back. So there was a practical thing as well. But it was partly about just getting closer to him, I guess. But I'm pleased you noticed. It's not done very often about male biographer subjects, certainly.
Right. Well, time's up.
Time's up. Yes. I were this side.
So thank you so much. You've given us such a wide range of fascinating facts about that, and it's a brilliant book. I think so.
Thank you.
just really warm, and there's so much in it, and very, very readable. So. And it has been very well received so far, and you said that it's onto its second print run.
They're just about to print another 1,000 or something, which, as I say, for a biography about a composer, it's more not waving the flag for me. That's lovely, but for music, you know, that it can be, you know, anyone can read about it.
Yeah. And you're doing lots of events and festivals to talk about the book as well.
Yeah, it's fun. And I got to read it out loud on Radio 4, which is much more fun than writing it, I tell you.
Brilliant. Okay, well, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's
should we just...